Well, hello everybody. This is the morning of April 5th in the year 2020. And as we know, due to circumstances beyond our control, we're not able to meet in person today. But these circumstances aren't beyond the control of our God. And so we're trusting Him to bring good out of even a coronavirus pandemic, and to continue to bring this creation to the place where our Messiah is ready to return. So may He come quickly, right? We had intended to meet together this evening at the building to discuss the final verses of the text in Proverbs 31, A Woman of Valor. We're going to study these last verses today, but before we focus on the last two amazing verses, I want to read the entire text. And as I always have since we've been meeting together over the last months, what I want all of us to do is to conjure up the pictures that the Spirit of God has begun to paint in our imaginations and our minds as a result of becoming more acquainted with this elusive woman of valor. A woman of valor who can find. She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax, and her hands work willingly. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, he plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff. Her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing. She laughs at the days to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat that bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. I read the entire text, even the verses that we're going to be studying together today in a little while, but I have something to ask of you. It's a return to the request that we all contribute ways that this woman of valor has begun to inspire us and even change us and teach us and mentor us and guide us in our own journey. What I would love for us all to do is use the next week, the time, the next 5 or 6 days, and send me examples and include your name, because if we were in a room together, I would be asking you to personally share these. So the best we can do is to utilize the technology at hand. And I was hoping to maybe create a Skype group, but to get everybody synchronized and to get the technology in place just feels a little beyond my reach. So this is the next best thing. Go ahead and send in the ways and the phrases and the insights and the inspirations that you have. And then what I'm going to do is send them out by way of a recording to all of you, hopefully by next Sunday. Sound good? So let's begin with the verse. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. So in a perfect world, mind you, every woman would marry her ideal man and have beautiful and grateful children together, and they would all live happily ever after. How are we to even begin to relate to this pinnacle of idealism? After all, we live in a world where there are the very concept of marriage and motherhood. Truly, it's been so distorted and maligned that it's difficult to even appreciate. Even those of us who are devoted to the principles of God, it is really challenging to appreciate this description of familial relationship. How many of us honestly react to this description of children blessing and husbands praising with a slightly cynical eye roll, maybe internally, if not literally? But at the heart of our human response, can we admit that there is a deep yearning for partnership and for fruitfulness? For partnership with a spouse and for fruitfulness that comes from that union, children, if you will. So the perfect world described here in Proverbs 31:28, it was corrupted early on. We talked about that when we were together. And I doubt that Cain was too concerned about blessing Eve as he ran for his life after murdering his brother Abel. In the meantime, since that point, creation has been groaning for redemption, hasn't it? Romans 8:19 through 23 talks about how the creation is in a place of groaning for redemption. But the ideal still exists. We won't experience it until all things are made new. But our spirits yearn for this scene to take place, the husband praising his bride and children calling her blessed. It's something that's deep within us. Revelation 21:5 describes the scene where all things are made new. And this yearning, this eternal yearning becomes satisfied, if you will. So for those who are married with physical children, yes, we crave the satisfaction of knowing that all of our efforts are not in vain. And for those who are not able to conceive, there tends to be a deep yearning for pregnancy often. And for singles, many of you yearn for a partner. Why so much yearning? Because this eternal desire to experience the blessing and praises is hardwired into the feminine soul. The woman of valor has many children, and they recognize the impact of her life on their own, and they rise to express it with words and with their lives. And her husband, he praises her. Think about that for a moment. We get glimpses of this sort of notice and appreciation in our physical life and in our day-to-day life. We do. We experience flashes, but much of the life of a wife and mother on a physical level is seemingly sacrificial. But here is the thing. Something deeper, richer, and more eternal is being described here. Remember, when we read these words describing the woman of valor, we must consider it on multi-levels. You see, the true fruit of a life lived in the unseen kingdom is inevitable. Every woman whose heart is connected to the eternal bridegroom will produce offspring, will have children. There will be spiritual children we possibly will not even meet in this lifetime. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But each act of love and kindness, it's like a pebble dropped into the water, creating ripples that go on and on and on. And our husband? Yes, he rejoices over us with singing. We see that happening and described in Zephaniah 3:17. It's easy to forget. But it is difficult to maintain those realities as part of our routine thought process, isn't it? We're too busy waiting to be noticed and appreciated by the ones who live under our roof. Thoughts like these, when is the last time my son or daughter called me? Or does this man even hear what I'm saying? Here is a secret. The woman of valor never asks herself those questions. She is all about being who she is without manipulation or emotional neediness. And the result? Her emotional needs are all ultimately met. To the extent we can give ourselves willingly to those who we are assigned to love, we will be rewarded in the right way and at the right time. And often we'll be required to wait a while. Children typically need to grow up and suffer enough to look back at their childhood and with mature eyes to see things more clearly. And husbands, they become numb from the mundaneness and the striving of life. Even those spiritual children for whom we pour out time and attention will abandon us sometimes. But we are not forgotten. Nothing is disregarded by the one who sees and hears. The reward we yearn for is often not experienced in this lifetime. Sometimes we get snippets. Embrace those moments. But we look forward to a day when we will hear our bridegroom say, "Well done." In considering the big picture of God's relationship to Israel, his bride, we see the nations blessing her. We see this in Malachi chapter 3. It says, "All the nations will call you blessed, for you shall be a delightful land," says the Lord of hosts. And the children of Israel, the offspring, are blessed. We see this in Isaiah 61:9. "Then their offspring will be known among the nations, and their descendants in the midst of the peoples. All who see them will recognize them, because they are offspring whom the Lord has blessed." Has this taken place yet on a level that is universal? Not yet, but is promised. And then there's the pinnacle of his praise, of God's praise for his own bride. We see this in Isaiah 62, verses 4 and 5. "Listen, you will also be a crown of beauty in the land of the Lord, and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. It will no longer be said to you, 'Forsaken,' nor to your land will it longer be said, 'Desolate,' but you will be called, 'My delight is in her,' and your land will be called, 'Married,' for the Lord delights in you." You may be thinking, hold on. I'm not in Israel. In fact, I'm a Gentile. Our Master Yeshua spoke to his followers, and he reminded them that many will come from the east and the west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 8:11. Records this promise. So regardless of our physical heritage, we are brought near and no longer excluded from the commonwealth of Israel. This promise we see in Ephesians 2:12. We have been grafted in to the cultivated olive tree of his people, as stated in Romans 11:23. So, all of this is fine and good on a grand scale, but what of the natural offspring of our marriage to our very physical husband? Because words of praise and gratitude may not be ringing in the air, some women get tired of waiting for the fruit of their labors to become ripe, and they jump ship before they even experience the built-in harvest that life eventually brings. I see a phenomenon today of women abandoning their homes, their families, in search of something more fulfilling. This is a theme in movies and in books. It's a seductive and prevalent message today. I see young and old alike who create an illusion of a more self-fulfilling life where they are noticed and appreciated. So they burn bridges back to the lives they originally invested in, only to find that they take themselves with them on whatever quest for recognition and appreciation they seek, and they end up sadly very alone. It is often most tempting to abandon a long race just before the finish line, isn't it? Does it sometimes feel as if the children you birthed, nurtured, and in whom you've invested so much fail to express appreciation or return the affection you crave? You know, I remember a time within the last few years, I was kind of having a pity party and thinking, gosh, all this love and attention and nurturing and self-sacrifice I've poured into these adult children of mine, do they even think about me? Yeah, they're all living great lives and I'm proud of them all at a distance, but they haven't even looked back. I think they just don't even realize I exist anymore. And I heard the still small voice of my father say, I know how that feels. And I thought, he allows us to experience what he experiences because his father's heart never, ever, ever forgets us. We're always in his mind. Yet how often do we go days and weeks and some even years without giving him a glance or a thought, let alone the attention and affection that he deserves? Just a thought. Are you willing to release your children, whether spiritual or physical offspring, to God's care with the emuna? There's a Hebrew word, emuna. That means faith in his sovereign love, that everything works together. Can we exercise that he'll bring everything around to a glorious ending at some point in the eternal future? Because I'm telling you something, immediate gratification is not something that the woman of valor requires. She loves extravagantly and without requiring affirmation and recognition. There is, however, a principle that eventually all things will be recognized for what they truly are. That's why it's hardwired into humanity to crave that. All things will be recognized for what they truly are someday, and also what they aren't. And children tend to mature to a place of returning to their roots and recognizing what matters beyond the ends of their own noses. And they do eventually bless the ones who have given them life, whether physically or spiritually. And her husband also, he praises her. The husband of our woman of valor, the one who sits with the elders at the gates, remember? He sees his bride, and he notices every selfless act she performs, and he praises her. In fact, he longs for her to respond to his voice. Wrong reference. This is from the Song of Solomon. It says, "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig has ripened its fruit, and the vines their blossoms. They've given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet. Your form is lovely." It's an invitation. Even when we have an earthly bridegroom who doesn't seem to see us, We live for one who sees and knows and who will gather us into himself. But we must be willing to continue forward, doing what we need to do with diligence, courage, kindness, trust, with emunah. Trust that we are not invisible to a husband who loves us fiercely. He says, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy, for I betrothed you to one husband, so that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin. That is a reference from 2 Corinthians 11:2. In Eden, the picture was clear, briefly. Adam loved Eve, unequivocally. But before long, the enemy of our souls attacked marriage viciously from very early on, and he continues to do so throughout the ages. I heard a wise teacher recently say, marriage is the front line of spiritual warfare. Marriage is the front line of spiritual warfare. As we bring our souls into alignment with God's original design, we will be called back to a relationship with him and also to oneness with the spouse we live with. And we will be able to love our husband with a sacred determination because of inner strength and external context that we choose to develop. And because the Spirit of God enables us to become the wife he wants us to be, and the mother, and the friend, the co-worker, the neighbor, and the disciple of our Messiah. The portrait of a woman who is blessed for her actions is a story I have long appreciated for many reasons. Let's look at her. Let's look at the Shunammite. The story can be found in 2 Kings chapter 4. She was considered a prominent woman, perhaps because she was in many ways a woman of valor. She recognizes a man of God when she encounters Elisha. She immediately seeks to meet the physical needs of this holy man by offering him food from her household. She also has the spark of an idea. Wisdom from another place sparks in her mind, and like a field to be planted, it grows, and she appeals to her husband to create an upstairs chamber so Elisha can have a place to rest when he travels through her town. She takes the initiative, and as a result of taking a risk and of becoming personally involved by using her available resources at hand in her own household, the prophet informs this childless woman that she will bear a son, because at this point she's childless and her husband is old. So the story goes on. She does birth a son, and this child grows to become a young man. One day he becomes very ill and he dies. The Shunammite woman knows what to do, and without delay she informs her husband, and I picture this happening in a confident and respectful way, but she informs him that she is going for help and that, listen to this, all would be well. She says to her husband, I'm going to get someone, hold tight, all will be well. Elisha returns with her and raises the young man to life. This woman's husband and son surely rise up and call her blessed. But oh, the testing of her faith in the meantime. There were surely moments of things looking hopeless and of her efforts feeling vain. Do you get it? She was able to rise while it was still night and to laugh at the future. We may think that our own children need to be resurrected to new life. Let's believe it will happen. At some point, whether or not we get to see it when or how we wish, let's just trust for it. We wonder if our marriage will ever provide the kind of satisfaction we long to experience, some of us. Well, let's enlarge the context and continue to build our own house, our own life, with strength and dignity. Giving life is a divine assignment. It really is, whether in this visible realm or in the invisible. Remember, we're invited to dwell in two realms simultaneously, like the woman on the shore who knows how to board that ship and go far out to sea to a place that is previously unknown to her, but she knows it's the place to go, and she brings back food. She's a woman of prayer. She's a woman constantly aware of both realms at once. She's always aware that there's an eternal consequence for everything she does or fails to do. And there's most certainly a time delay between each choice and the consequence it brings. That span of time, ladies, that's called the test. That's the test. We have a profound example of a child who rises up and calls his mother blessed, as we read the entire context or text of Ishakael today. Because remember, these words are the tribute that Solomon himself gave to his own mother, Bathsheba. Our text is a tribute by a child to his mother. I smile as I picture him saying to her, perhaps as others looked on, many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. So as we move on to the final few sentences in our text, we see it stated that charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. It's kind of cryptic, isn't it? Each of us is prone to be deceived by charm. Each of us. Well, what is charm? And why is it so seductive? These are a few words that define the word chen, C-H-E-N, the Hebrew word for charm. The words are enchanting, fascinating, spellbinding, ravishing. Those are the English words for our word charm. Why do we find a warning regarding charm here at the end of our text describing the woman of valor? I think it's because she is not fooled by charm, and she doesn't deceive others by using it. But is charm ever a good thing? Interestingly, the word chen also means grace, which surely is a lovely virtue, right? And as I think about the storybook version of Prince Charming, the ideas conjured are of a handsome and selfless prince whose chief aim in life is to save his princess, true love personified. Charm is dangerous and deceitful because it represents manipulation by way of creating a false impression. That is the warning that's buried in these words. Charm flatters by distracting with an external personality that does not reflect an internal reality. In other words, the internal and the outward do not really match. It's something that people use as a tool sometimes. In short, it's not truthful. Charm likes to employ whatever is necessary to win a person over. I confess, I've come to the place where when I meet a person, whether they're male or female, if they're overly charming, I immediately am suspicious. Because more often than not, I have found those who drip with charm to be deceitful. charm in this way that's dangerous, it's not motivated by love, you see. It's motivated by selfishness. This seductive force can even fool the person who's wielding it. It kind of becomes a pseudo personality that they wear. They don't even know that it isn't truly them. It's an ego expressing itself. So in a way, what I'm saying is that charm versus authenticity. But is charm always deceitful? Perhaps not. But a true person doesn't need to hide behind it continually, right? And this is interesting. The Hebrew word for charm, or chen, is grace. Well, God is gracious. He does not deceive. And Noah, of course, found grace, or chen, in the eyes of the Lord, and his household was saved as a result. So grace is a good thing, surely. Well, is there an inferred warning that even grace can be deceptive? The definition for grace, the true definition for grace biblically, is best described as favor, God's favor. Well, when one uses this idea of favor as kind of an alluring bait, it is most certainly dodgy. What do I mean? Well, how many of us have been presented with a version of grace that releases us from any and all responsibility to actually behave in a way that reflects the one we claim to serve? It is because of God's favor that we are made free to choose to be his disciple, obviously. And his true disciples are not looking for excuses to remain unchanged. They understand that his favor isn't a license to behave badly. His true bride is seeking to make herself ready to meet him without spot or wrinkle. We see that stated in Ephesians 5:27. God's favor, his grace, is pure and wonderful, truly. But we are warned not to be deceived into thinking that our conduct isn't important. Do you see? The woman of valor knows that grace can be deceitful, but also that beauty is vain. Hold on. You mean we're not allowed to appreciate beauty? Or to make ourselves more beautiful? Or to beautify our homes and our world? Isn't that what we've been talking about for the last weeks as we've studied this text? Is the goal of the woman of valor to resist beautification? Is that what this phrase is telling us? The word says that he has made everything beautiful in his time, and he has also set eternity in our hearts. I'm referencing Ecclesiastes 3:11. So when we read the phrase, beauty is vain. Apparently, true beauty is tied closely with a concept of eternity. If he has set eternity in our hearts and he's made everything beautiful in its time, perhaps we need to look deeper than the thickness of our skin here. There's something more going on to the idea of beauty. So, as usual, the key to understanding this mystery is to understand true definitions. The word beauty that is regarded as vain in this word, in our text, is the Hebrew word yapha, Y-A-P-H-A, yapha. And that's the word we see here as a warning in Proverbs 31:30. Charm is deceitful and yapha is vain. This is the word that describes the external appearance of things, and it means to be fair or handsome. That's not a bad thing, but it has the potential to prompt vanity, because that's what we tend to do with beauty. It prompts vanity and it becomes manipulative in such a powerful way, in such a subtle way. God has ordained for his creation to be adorned with beauty. If we turn to Isaiah 61, verses 10 and 11, we read, "For he has clothed me with garments of salvation. He has wrapped me with a robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with a garland, and as a bride adorns herself with jewels. For as the earth brings forth sprouts, and as a garden causes things to be sown, and they spring up." Obviously, beauty plays a vital role in experiencing quality of life. In fact, I believe beauty has become undervalued in many ways because it's so important. And because beauty is so powerful in affecting our emotions and our thoughts, it can be misused, because we live in a fallen world. And women are in a precarious, unique position to misuse this power, because it is a power. So beauty, or yafa, is often vain. Few are able to resist succumbing to the powers of the manipulation that beauty can wield. Nevertheless, beauty is a beautiful thing. What we must remember is that there is an inner beauty and an outer beauty. And as with everything, there is a tendency to consider the external at the expense of the internal. And instead of true beauty, as a result of this, unfortunately, there can be shame. There is a quote by Akiva Tetz, and it says, "Tension between inner core and outer vessel began when mankind fell. Maintaining harmony becomes a challenging task. Ideally, the body will live out and reflect the voice of the spirit perfectly. But when the inner reality is perfectly reflected in the outer, shame is not possible. When it isn't reflected perfectly, shame is the result." So true beauty demands that the inside is represented accurately on the outside. Which brings us to the definition of internal beauty. There's another word in the Word of God that refers to this kind of beauty, and it's Tiferet. T-I-F-E-R-E-T, Tiferet. This word for beauty denotes balance and harmony. That's what Tiferet means. Balance and harmony. And this kind of beauty is not vain. It is pure and it is holy. And when this kind of internal beauty, this kind of internal balance and harmony is reflected on the outside, that kind of beauty is not vain. That kind of beautiful beauty is actually beautiful. There's a phrase, "Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary." From Psalm 96:6. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. God values beauty. God is beautiful. We see this word for beauty used to describe the garments of Aaron the priest. And we see that in Exodus 28:2. His outer clothing was meant for glory and for beauty. The inner and the outer in perfect harmony. The standard of beauty is God's desire for all of his people. Remember, we are all called to a life of royalty. We are a royal priesthood. So if we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 26 and we read verses 16 through 19, here's what we see. "This day the Lord your God command you to do these statutes and ordinances." Okay, this passage is where there's a call out for God's people to remember what his intention for us truly is. And we continue. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with your soul. You have today declared the Lord to be your God, and that you would walk in his ways and keep his statutes, his commandments, and his ordinances, and listen to his voice. The Lord has today declared you to be his people, a treasured possession, as he promised you, and that you should keep all his commandments, and that he will set you high above all nations, which he has made for praise, fame, and beauty, for beauty, and that you shall be a consecrated people to the Lord your God, for he has spoken. God's intention when he gave his word, his Torah, to the people was for their lives to be so beautiful in every way that the nations would see it and they would come and seek him out. So let's regroup. Charm is deceitful at times and beauty can be vain, but we see the word but. So we have an important contrast to consider. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. In comparison to the precariousness and the dangers of charm and beauty, Yafa beauty, in external beauty, a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. His true name, which means I am, is the one she fears. Not fear as in cowering in uncertainty and shame. Not fear of approaching or drawing close, but reverence. A deep recognition of his majesty and sovereignty and awe. She allows who he is to define who she is, and she is praised as a result. We are told that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Proverbs 9:10 states that. We've all heard that. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Do we live in a culture today that is characterized by this fear of God? Do most people revere him and recognize him as their king? Certainly not. So, all we need to do is look around and see the results of not fearing him. Because we're surrounded by voices who do not fear him. And many of those voices are charming. And they are spoken by people who look on the surface to be beautiful. And it is so easy to be deceived. The woman of valor lives a life characterized by true beauty, by Tiferet beauty. And so her beauty on the external, the Yafa, is never, ever dangerous or vain. The inner and the outer are in sync. There is no conflict. The inner world of balance and harmony is expressed by her outer appearance. Even the way she dresses and the way she speaks and her behavior. What does her life of true beauty, what does it look like? It is many things. But the overall defining quality is this. Like we've talked about, ladies, all along, it's balanced. True beauty is balance. And the woman of valor is never extreme. She's always in perfect balance and harmony, internally and externally. She is balanced and she is harmonious. And she is stable. And she's able to laugh because she doesn't fear the future. There's a quote I like. It says, "Nothing makes its way more directly to the soul than beauty." Powerful. It's so powerful. Nothing makes its way directly to the soul like beauty does. And real beauty, in our world, it is elusive, isn't it? And I think even among God's people, beauty unfortunately tends to be underrated. But its function in the world is life-giving and powerful. We need to return to beauty. And as women, we have a unique assignment to beautify. Well, how do we do that? First of all, we must become and remain devoted followers and students of the one who lived life in perfect balance, beauty, and harmony. I'm talking about our Messiah, Yeshua, the one who lived a life of valor, of true valor for all to see. He, as we talked about in earlier weeks, is the only one who has ever walked this earth living out all of the characteristics of valor perfectly. We have his words and the stories about his life here in our physical world in the Word of God as a guide for our own journey. He said, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life, in the book of John. As we begin to internalize this truth, we become better at reflecting his beauty. We go to the source, we go to the well, don't we? We live in a world of perfecting, not perfection. Do you hear me? Our lives should be all about bringing repair. And we're trying to perfect, and we're in the process. We are not about living a life of perfectionism. Because here's the thing, the imperfections in life are part of the journey to do the repair work. That's how he has planned it. And our beloved is faithfully equipping, providing, guiding, and loving us along the way. Our role of helping all those around us to meet their potential is the God-breathed instinct, which is distinctly feminine. But what does this look like on a practical level? Let's talk about that. Years ago, I heard about a study done among a group of men to determine what the ideal beautiful woman looks like. I'll bet I have your attention now. They were all presented with a spectrum of women's silhouettes, just the silhouettes, ranging from stick skinny to very large. So all the body types in this entire range were presented to them. Every body type in between super skinny and not such, overweight, okay? Most men, by far, selected mid-range body type. Not skinny and not fat. And the results were surprising because it was expected that they would pick, in certain cultures, women that tended to be too thin, or in others, a little chunkier. Overall, the majority of men selected right in the middle, not too much of one and not too much of the other. In that same study, men were presented with a selection of female faces. Now, the results of this was fascinating. These weren't just silhouettes, but these were photographs of different women, many different women. And the overall consensus revealed a similar result. The same few faces were repeatedly selected. This time, the contrast wasn't between thin and thick, but the faces that appealed universally had one interesting feature in common. And at first, it was difficult for those who were giving this test to even figure out, but this is what they discovered. The faces that people found universally beautiful, they were especially symmetrical. You see, most human faces, when studied carefully, are subtly asymmetrical. If we put a line down the center of our face and we repeated one side in an opposite way on the other side in a photograph, which is kind of a crazy thing to do just for kicks. We don't look like ourselves anymore because our faces are not perfectly symmetrical. But in this beauty study, the faces that were selected were the ones that were perfectly symmetrical, or nearly, the left and the right side. So to sum it up, the results of this study about beauty proved that we as humans find beauty in balance or symmetry. But we as humans all tend toward extremes. We each do. That's the nature of being human. Not only is physical beauty characterized by balance, but internal beauty, as we've talked about, requires balance as well. And to the extent that our lives are lived in any extreme, beauty is compromised. So the secret to achieving beauty in our life, both internal and external beauty, is to seek balance. Isn't that interesting? Well, I can give you many, many, many examples, and if we were in a room together, it would be great fun to explore this. And maybe the future holds that opportunity for us. I hope so. Examples are limitless, but here are a few of the ways that balance brings beauty. First, let's consider one of my favorites, the balance between form and function. Some of us are more prone to favor form. In a way, it's more of a feminine, it's more feminine to favor form overall, generally speaking. Women favor the way things look more than the way things function. Now, this isn't carved in stone, but overall. That's why men who favor function don't see a problem with a worn, ugly, oversized leather chair placed in the middle of a room so that they can see the television from any angle without having to move their head. You laugh, but it's something that I see over and over again. And they'll pick up something that is just beautiful, like perhaps a vase that a woman would go out and purchase because the colors just make sense in the room. And he'll say, "What is this for? What does it do?" That's a very masculine question to ask because they, by nature, favor function. So for those who favor form, everything has to look good, really good, all the time. Function isn't relevant. That's the extreme of those who favor form. This person has a house, let's say, and it's very polished and attractive, but impossible to live in. Cooking is too messy, but the kitchen looks awesome. And guests are too disruptive, so the kitchen's rarely used. And children, well, they're definitely not able to contribute to overall tidiness. And the furniture is to admire, not to be used. This is not a beautiful home, even if the color scheme is ideal. But the opposite extreme is the one whose home is all about function. No artwork is hung because that's unnecessary. No music plays in the background because that's just, well, it's superfluous, isn't it? It's not, what function does it have? Furnishings are sparse and barely adequate. Food is nutritious, but not so delicious. And there's no need to set the table. Let's just use paper plates and keep things simple. No thought is given to creating an atmosphere that fosters connection and creativity. Only survival. This is not a beautiful home either. Now let's enter a home that is beautiful by our new definition. A mezuzah marks the doorway when we enter this home because it's a holy place. It's set apart from the chaos of the outside world. The table has been carefully set to signal that we as guests have been prepared for. Furnishings are attractive yet inviting for family and friends to sit and to connect. Each space has been thoughtfully planned out and the atmosphere fosters pleasantness and peace. There is order, yet everything has a purpose. Even the decorative items serve as reminders of beautiful memories. Form and function are in perfect balance. Let's consider music. The importance of balance in music for it to be beautiful. If the beat is too dominant and there's no melody, that's not really beautiful. If there's a melody and it's chaotic and there's not a beat, still it lacks. And if it's out of tune and it lacks harmony, we cringe at the dissonance, don't we? So music is another area that requires balance to be beautiful. Are you getting it? Okay, let's consider another one. Let's talk about art. Any artist knows that to create a beautiful painting, there has to be a contrast of light and dark, but it has to be in balance. It has to have visual balance. There is an internal recognition of visual composition done correctly. We know when it's right. And there has to be a certain amount of symmetry present. It is interesting to think about that through history, as internally human nature has become more and more and more out of sync with their creator. What they produce, humans that is, in the form of art, music, fashion, whatever, has less and less and less beauty and balance. Have you ever gone into a modern art museum and you're supposed to appreciate a large canvas that really isn't beautiful? And you know that, but it might not be the popular thing to express. So you just kind of sit and you cock your head and you stare at it and you think in your mind, I don't quite get it. But there are people around you saying, oh, this is beautiful. But you know internally it's not beautiful because it doesn't have the balance that real beauty requires for art to be truly beautiful. The same could be said of music. So through the ages, as mankind becomes more and more out of sync with their creator, architecture, art, fashion, visual arts, everything has become more and more out of sync externally as a result. It's a fascinating study. But I digress. Let's consider fashion for a moment. All right, now, picture a stiletto shoe. And if we were together, ladies, I would have one. I would dig one up somewhere. Not from my own shoe collection. But I would find a stiletto shoe really high, at least 4-inch heel. And it has a great deal of glitter. That's at the far end of our spectrum, okay? I know that you're laughing because you don't picture Robin wearing stiletto shoes that are glittery. I don't like shiny clothes ever. It's kind of a personal joke. Anyway, that's at the far end of our spectrum, this stiletto shoe. We will call it form. I consider it bad form, but that's what we're going to call this extreme example of form, because it's all about how it looks. Now, let's slide over to the opposite end of the spectrum and imagine, and I would bring this in to show you, an orthopedic and very sensible shoe. Thick rubber sole. Let's make it black. Not what you respond with in your mind as saying, oh, wow, that's beautiful, right? Bit too functional. So we have form in an extreme at one end, and we have function in an extreme at the other end. You get the idea, all right? Form and function have to come into balance to be beautiful. Or regarding fashion and modesty, let's think of at one end of the spectrum, we have bikini, and at the other end of the spectrum, we have burqa. All right, two extremes. Beautiful clothing isn't a religious uniform that conceals a feminine shape entirely, like a big sack. It isn't that. It isn't the kind of clothing that draws attention to itself because of its plainness. That's not beautiful. We know that instinctively. But on the other hand, it isn't dictated by the trends of the day. Barely their clothing. We, as women of valor, can express our individually, we can express our individuality and our creativity in a balanced way. We can express our individuality and creativity in a balanced way. And we can do it beautifully because balance is beautiful. A final example of this principle is found in the way kindness and truth are joined together in Proverbs 3:3. Let's turn there for a moment. Proverbs 3:3 says, "Do not let kindness and truth leave you. Bind them around your neck and write them on the tablet of your heart." Kindness, or chesed. Truth, or emet. These need to be bound together in order to reflect a life of beauty. What do I mean? When these two, that can be extreme in and of themselves, when expressed to the exclusion of the other, when they're joined together to provide a balanced approach to our thoughts, our words, and our deeds, the result is beautiful. What do I mean? One who is very pragmatic and truthful can tend to be hurtful. But one who has too much kindness, thinking it always has to be nice, without the truth, risks falling far short of wisdom. I know that we've all seen extreme examples of each, and we've both leaned toward examples of extremes of each, because none of us is able to walk perfectly in balance all the time. All of us fall on all of these spectrums to the right or to the left. It's kind of fun, actually, and helpful to think about these things and realize where we fall, towards this or toward that, and then say, God, how can I bring this closer to balance so that my life can express true beauty or tefer? Too much of one to the exclusion of the other will obscure the beauty. Let kindness and truth be bound around your neck as a beautiful adornment. And the fact that it's around our neck, that kind of denotes the idea that it's going to affect our words. It's going to affect our thoughts. Now, let's travel full circle and consider our woman of valor. She values home. Her husband is respected and admired because she is secure and happy in his marriage. She's beautiful. Her life reflects balance. She doesn't talk too much or too little. She isn't too much at rest or she isn't too busy. She prepares garments that are comfortable yet attractive. She prepares food that is nutritious yet delicious. Her life reflects one who has a very personal and secret relationship with her husband, yet she is available and willing to help those around her who need her attention. She is not so spiritual as to be unaware of her environment. And she is not so physically oriented that she is not tuned in to the voice of God. She is able to look beyond present circumstances and to encourage everyone that the sun will rise again. She has a rich internal world, and her external life reflects the depth of her faith. She is industrious, and creative and content. She brings everything in her life to potential by nurturing, protecting, and by loving. She fears the Lord. Proverbs 24, 4 and 5 says, by wisdom a house is built. Or let's say, by wisdom a life is built. And by understanding it is established. And by knowledge the rooms of this life are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. The woman of valor builds her house. And we praise her, don't we? And finally, we see, give her the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates, as the final phrase in our text, which describes the woman of valor, the Eshet Kayil. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates. This concludes our study, ladies. But it doesn't, because I still hope to hear from you this week. And I also hope and pray that the words that we have, that Solomon wrote to praise his own mother and to bless her all those years ago, which are ordained and inspired by our heavenly bridegroom to mentor us, to instruct us, to encourage us, to inspire us. I hope that these words are so internalized by each of us that we become more valorous and that we become more content in being the women that he's created us to be. So let's pray. Our Father, our King, and our Beloved, thank you for the words that, though written long ago, are so relevant not only to our time, but to each individual soul. And I pray that wherever we are as individual women at this moment, that your Spirit, as only it can do, will speak to each of us and encourage us and to reassure us that each of us carry a spark, a facet, a particular way to reflect to the world around us and to our households in particularly, your beauty. Father, thank you for the women that you've placed in my life. As I think of each of them, and I often do, I see women of valor, none of us perfect, but each of us reflections in our own way of who you are. Bring us together as a community to reflect that better, and individually grow us, bring us into balance, and help us not to give up during those tests of time, between the time of inspiration and the time of experiencing the results of your reality, of the word that you've put in our minds. Lord, let us be faithful. And Lord, I thank you for the fact that we can study and learn together, and that you are going to continue to teach us until we are without spot or blemish and ready to meet you at that day appointed. In the name of our Messiah, amen.